This conversation between Bill Werber and Walter Langford is being recorded in Bill's home in Naples, Florida, on October 24th, 1988. Bill, tell me first about your start in baseball.
Well, I started to play ball when I was a kid on the sand lots of Berwyn, Maryland.
Like most kids in those days.
Yeah, and then I graduated from there to Tech High School in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And while I was playing baseball for Tech High School in Washington, D.C., a fellow who later became the head of the Catholic Youth Organization in Washington, D.C., noted either my play personally for Tech High School or saw the statistics in the newspaper, because he asked me to play summer ball for the Georgetown Knickerbockers, and they were the independent champions of Washington. Mm-hmm. And this fellow Pete Haley, that was running the Knickerbockers, was a very knowledgeable baseball guy, and he'd assembled a team of mostly semi-pro ball players who had played in the minors and had come back home. And they had a good team. And playing with these much older players and more experienced players, I picked up some pretty good knowledge and picked it up rather quick.
Sure.
And Pete was interested in me and what I was doing and one thing or another, and helped me a great deal. And of course, from the Georgetown Knickerbockers, I graduated and went down to Duke University. Incidentally, while I was playing for Tech High School, Doc White, who had been with the Chicago Hitless Wonders,
yeah, sure,
was the director of athletics of the Washington High Schools. And Doc White had taken an interest in me and had obtained for me the entrance exams, or rather the questions that would be asked me for entrance at the Naval Academy and at Yale. And he was interested in seeing me go to either the Naval Academy, where Chief Bender was the coach, or to the Yale, where Smokey Joe Wood was the coach. But I won't go into it. I didn't go to Yale or Naval Academy. I ended up at Duke University, which was also a good baseball school, and had an exceptionally fine coach, Possum Whitty, George Whitty,
sure, sure,
who had played in the major leagues for a number of years. Excellent coach, smart baseball man, much addicted to strong drink, which caused a loss of his position at Duke. And at the beginning of my junior year, at the end of my sophomore year, Jack Combs came in at Duke, but I went to Duke. And in any event, George Whitted, when I showed up at Duke, evidently thought I had some baseball future, because a large number of scouts began to show up at the Duke freshman games. And I'm sure George was responsible for having these people there. And I think George possibly had in mind, although I have no way of knowing or proving this, of possibly getting some type of remuneration from these ball clubs with whomever I might sign.
Yeah.
And actually, the Yankees did help me through three of my remaining years at Duke. Mm-hmm. I agreed to play with the Yankees and sign a contract when I got through with Duke University. There's an interesting little story connected with that. These scouts had all been pursuing me at some length while I was a freshman at Duke, and the scout that I was most impressed with was Paul Critchell of the Yankees. He spoke my language, and he was a neat, clean, well-educated, polite man, and the Yankees, of course, were well-known. Ruth was at his height of his prowess, so I shook hands with Critchell and agreed to do certain things, and Critchell agreed to do certain things, and he agreed to go to Washington and confirm all of this with my father. Mm-hmm. And my father called me on the phone perhaps a week later and said Art Devlin, who was scouting for the Giants, had been into his office And he described the package which Art Devlin had offered. Dad had played ball with Art Devlin at Central High School in Washington and had known him personally. And he described to me the package that Art Devlin had offered, which actually was about twice as much as the Yankees had offered. And the Yankees had given me a very good deal. And I said to him over the telephone, I said, Dad, but I have agreed with Mr. Critchell to do such and so, and I've shaken hands on him. And my father said, well, if you agreed to do that with a man, you shook hands with him, that ends it.
That's right.
So I still feel that today. If I tell you something, you don't need my name on a piece of paper. The word is of greater value than...
The word is your bond.
And that's correct. And my dad felt the same way about it. Good. So anyhow, that's the background of how I got into pro ball.
Yeah. Well, now, when you graduated and went with the Yankees, where did they send you?
Well, I graduated in June of 1930. I'm rather proud of the fact that when I stepped up to get my diploma, I was also the recipient of the Robert E. Lee Award, which is the highest award that Duke University gives to a graduating senior.
Wonderful.
It's based upon athletics, academics, and extracurricular activities. Mm-hmm. And when I received my diploma, the Dean of the university, Dr. William Hain Wanamaker, looked me in the eye and said, William, I don't know of anyone that I'd rather hand this to than you. And it was in a very soft, didn't anybody hear it but me, but I heard him, and I remembered that. And so anyway, I had notification from the Yankees to report to them at the Chase Hotel in St. Louis, Missouri. And been from the St. Louis area for a part of your life. You know where the Chase Hotel is.
Still there.
There.
Yeah.
Out there by the park.
Yeah.
And so I was with the Yankees from June until somewhat after July the 4th. And as a matter of fact, I traveled with them through the West and came back to New York with them. And played in the second game of a doubleheader on July the 4th. Mm-hmm. Larry was the regular shortstop. George Westling was the substitute shortstop. And in the first game of that doubleheader on July the 4th, Larry got hurt, and Westling, I'd been rooming with his bag on the Western trip. I hadn't seen George. He was out gallivanting around different places. George got sick. It was an awfully hot day. Mm-hmm. So the second game, Bob Shawkey, who was then the manager, came over to where I was sitting on my stool. He said, you're the shortstop for the second game. Mm-hmm. So I did pretty well that game. I think I had 3 for 2, 2 for 3, and scored two or three times. Ruth hit a home run, I had a big day. As a matter of fact, the next day, the newspapers all featured my performance. I handled about 11 chances in the field, and...
good start.
Sir?
A good start.
Yeah. It was right funny, too, because Blayholder was pitching and Rick Farrell was catching, and Blayholder threw two strikes. I could see the ball perfectly well, but I was so paralyzed I couldn't swing at it. And then Rick Farrell, who was doing the catching, thought to himself, well, we'll throw some bad balls, see if we can get this rookie to chase him. But I would have chased him, but I couldn't move. And then he lost control, and I walked.
Uh-huh.
And the papers described it the next day that with two balls on him, the rookie watched the next balls go by with two strikes on him. The rookie watched the next four balls go by him with the coolness of a veteran.
Uh-huh.
I never told him I was scared to death. I just let it rest at that.
Yeah, yeah.
But then the Yankees in mid-July felt that I needed more experience, which I did, and they sent me up to Albany, New York, in the Eastern League. Mm-hmm. And I hit about 355 for Albany for the rest of that summer, and at the end of the summer was voted the most valuable player in the Eastern League and was awarded $500 worth of furniture at Blinn's department store. And I had been married at the end of my junior year, and in 1930 it was Depression time.
You know it.
$500 worth of furniture seemed like $1 million to me.
Yep. Yep.
So that's it for the early year.
And 31, where did you play?
31, I went to spring training with the Yankees, and the Yankees sent Dixie Walker and myself to Toledo, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And I was over at Toledo, Ohio, Walker and myself under Casey Stengel. And in the middle of the summer at Toledo, the Home Security Bank, a large banking system throughout Ohio,
yeah,
closed its doors. It failed. And I went down to the bank one day to cash a check, and there was a note on a little branch bank: the bank is closed in the hands of the receivers. And I had 50 cents in my pocket.
Oh,
and I went over to the ballpark offices adjacent to the bank, and there was a notice over there that the Yankees had recalled Walker and myself, and I was to report to Newark, and he was to report to Toronto. And I had 50 cents in my pocket to make the trip, and I had the young lady I'm still married to, and a small boy. And so I finished out that summer playing shortstop for Newark.
Uh-huh. Well, they had some great teams in the 30s themselves.
Yeah, that's right. We had a good ball club there. And then 32, I went to the spring training with the Yankees again, and they sent me to Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And I played 1932 with Buffalo in the International League.
Yeah.
And then from that time on, I was in the majors.
Yeah. Now, in 33, you went from the Yankees to Boston early in the season.
I had the Yankee job at shortstop sewed up in spring training.
Uh-huh.
I'd hit about 350 in spring training in 1933. And I had played most all of the games at spring training, ahead of Larry and ahead of Crosetti.
Mm-hmm.
And when we broke spring training, we started off up around Memphis or Birmingham, I'm not sure which. And Yawkey had acquired the Red Sox,
mm-hmm,
during the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a scout by the name of McAllister that had been following the Yankees. And he was there for the purpose of buying a shortstop. See, the Yankees had three of them. And so McCarthy, who was then managing the Yankees, put Crosetti in to let McAllister look at Crosetti. And Crosetti looks a doggone good that they ended up keeping Crosetti and selling me,
mm-hmm,
to the Red Sox.
Mm-hmm. It was a sale, not a trade.
It was a sale.
Mm-hmm.
They sold... At the same time, they sold George Pepgrass and Dusty Cook,
uh-huh,
to the Red Sox.
Uh-huh.
That was in the spring of 33.
Yeah. Well, you got in a lot of games with the Red Sox.
Yeah.
108 games with them.
Yeah.
And that was under Marty McManus.
That's right.
Yeah. They weren't the best team in the league, but they had some good names there. Now, before we go any further, let me ask you this. Is there one game in all of your major league career that sticks in your mind and like a game you'll never forget for one reason or another?
Well, Well, there are really three ball games that I remember, I guess, more than any other games. One was at Boston. Two of them were at Boston. One of the ball games. I've always been a... If you talk to people who knew me as a player, you would find, I think, that they would always label me as an exceptional competitor and a hustler. I was a battler.
I've read that, Joe.
I've always gave it 110%.
Mm-hmm.
And when the umpire hollered play ball, you might be my friend off the field, but it was a type of warfare with me. I was paid. I was paid to win ball games,
sure.
and so I tried hard. And this particular day in Boston, I was trying hard, and I made four errors. The last error I made, I went over behind the pitcher and behind second base and speared a ball with my gloved hand, and I wheeled around. I had to wheel around and to use my momentum to throw, and when I cut the ball loose, it went over the first baseman's head, and it must have gone 55 rows up into the stands in Boston. And of course, all the people, this was the fourth error, and all of the people in the stands let out this enormous big boo. And then finally, somebody hit a little pop fly to me at shortstop, which I caught. And the result of catching that pop fly was a big chorus of hooray, derisive hooray. I just made a mental resolve from that time on that I would do the very best that I could, but that I would give a minimal amount of attention to both criticism and praise.
Right.
If they booed me, they paid to do it.
Yep.
If they praised me, I'd take it lightly. So I never permitted from that time on, that ball game, I never permitted from that time on the people to get to me, either one way or the other. That ball game stayed with me a long time, and it happened
sure.
early.
Yep.
And another time in Boston, I hit four doubles off of Mel Harder. And Mel Harder was a difficult fellow for me to hit. He could always read my mind. I moved around in the box a great deal. I didn't always assume the same position each time I came up. But no matter how I stood, whether I used a square or an open stance, or was in the back of the box or the front of the box, Mel Harder could read my mind, and he was a very effective pitcher against me. But this particular day, I hit four doubles off of Mel Harder. That was in 1934 in Boston. Incidentally, and you can check this out, this is a fact, I am the only player that has hit four consecutive doubles in both leagues. The only Major League Baseball player to hit four consecutive doubles in both leagues.
Wonderful.
Now, I hit the other four consecutive doubles with Cincinnati in August of 1939 against the St. Louis Cardinals. And this is another game that I remember because I hit a fifth double in that ball game. But the fifth double was in an extra inning, and we were playing the Cardinals, and in 39 the Cardinals were chasing us the entire summer.
Mm-hmm.
And this fifth double tied up the game. We had to call the game because we were going to catch a train out of Cincinnati to go to Boston,
mm-hmm.
and the Cardinals were going to New York, and we replayed the game later in the season, which we won.
Yeah.
But hitting those five doubles, and each time I hit one of those doubles, it was to either tie the ball game or put us a run ahead.
Wow.
And I remember the ball game because Mize was hitting home runs that day, and I was hitting doubles. He'd hit a home run and put the Cardinals up, and I'd come up and hit a double and bring the Reds back up there. But I hit five doubles that day, four of them consecutive doubles in regulation.
And how many innings did you go?
I think it went 12 innings.
Uh-huh. And then called, but so you catch the train.
That's right. It was called because we had to both get out of there and catch the train. And we resumed the ball game later in the season, and at the period at which it stopped when they came to Cincinnati.
Yeah, you beat them out by 4.5 games that year.
Yeah. Well, we knocked them off when they came to Cincinnati about September the 25th or 26th. Another thing that you might be interested in knowing, I was the first Major League Baseball player ever to appear on national television.
No.
Now, I only knew this because here, as recent as about a summer ago, a boy in the rack room out at Quail Creek Country Club told me this, reading a trivia book.
Is that right?
Yeah, he said, one day I came in there, he said, who was the first Major League Baseball player ever to appear on national TV? I said, I don't have the slightest idea. He said, you were. It's a sporting news trivia book?
Yeah. I know the book.
And he showed it to me. And this was in the latter part of August in 1939.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the leadoff hitter for Cincinnati at Ebbets Field.
Mm-hmm. And they televised it.
Yes, sir.
Boy, that's something. Yeah.
So the first player to ever hit four consecutive doubles in
each
in both leagues.
Yep. All right. Now, let's go back to that 33 team. Do I have it right that in 33 that Bucky Walters was?
He played third base.
Yeah.
Before
they converted him.
Not a bad third baseman.
No, he wasn't.
Could throw that ball. He could really throw it. And he started off as the third baseman in 1934, too.
Uh-huh.
And I started off as the shortstop in 34. Bucky Harris sold him to Philadelphia, and Jimmy Wilson made a pitcher out of him. And then they bought Larry. And Larry came over to the Red Sox, and they put Larry at short and moved me to third.
Mm-hmm. Now, in 34, Bucky Harris came in as your manager in Boston.
Best manager I ever played for.
Is he really?
Yes, sir.
But then Bill McCracken.
Bill McCracken was a great one.
Yeah. He's...
He and Harris were a great deal alike, except that Harris had more camaraderie going with the ball players and was in among the ball players and was at times leading a lot of devilment and good humor among the ball players, and McKechnie more or less stood aloof. But a fine gentleman.
All right. Now, you, among the pitchers that year, you had Wes Farrell.
Yes, sir.
Talk about Wes a minute or two.
Wes Farrell left Oak Ridge Military School, which was run by a man by the name of Holt. I first pitched against Wes Farrell when he's pitching for Oak Ridge. He came down and pitched against the Duke freshman team. And, Wes Farrell was a hell of a good pitcher. And Wes Farrell, his first 4 years in the league with Cleveland, won about 20, 22, 23, 24 games.
Yeah.
He won over 20 ball games his first 4 years with Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
And then Wes hurt his arm. I don't recall now how he hurt it. Now, Wes Farrell was a highly competitive individual.
The greatest.
He was an irascible cuss. He did not smoke. He did not drink. Wes saved his money. He was good to his family. He and Rick took money that they made out of baseball, and they equipped the farm of their mother and father in Guilford County with the latest in dairy farm equipment. they were both good boys, both good competitors, but after Wes hurt his arm, Cleveland sort of gave up on him. And Rick persuaded the Red Sox. Rick was over with the Red Sox. They bought him from St. Louis. And Rick was with the Red Sox, and he persuaded Eddie Collins to get Wesley over there, that Wesley could still pitch.
Good.
But when Wesley came over to the Red Sox, he was mostly pitching with his head and his heart. Now, another thing about Wesley Farrell is that he was a damn good hitter.
You know it.
And pretty good ball player outside of that. And and at times when things got rough and we were short in the outfield at Boston, Wes could go out in the outfield and play outfield for you.
He and George Uele were crowned as the best hitters in baseball at that time.
I've seen Wesley in a close ball game where it looked like the manager was going to have to use the pitch hitter. Wesley would get up off the bench and go down to the bat rack, and he'd get a bat out of the bat rack, and he'd parade up and down in front of Bucky Harris or Cronin, who was manager, and parade up and down, you know, and shake the bat and ask him to be sent up to hit. And if he's sent up to hit, he'd hit the ball.
Yeah, true. In 33, you played with Smead Jolly.
Well, Smead was a buffoon.
That's right.
Smead could hit the ball.
Oh, yeah, that's all he could do, though.
Yeah, but...
Joe Sewell tells the story about the time when they were playing the White Sox, when Smead was with the White Sox in old Cleveland Park. And a ball was hit out there and went right smack between his legs. It bounced off of the concrete wall and bounced right through his legs again.
Yeah.
And then he raced after it, picked it up, and threw it way up into the stands.
Yeah.
And he says, Smead had a terrible arm, and he just stood there and says, my God, I didn't know I could throw the ball that far. That was his only comment about it.
Well, now, you know, this happened in 33. They used to take, Boston had, in 1933, they had a little slope that ran up to the wall, and at the top of the slope, they had a little 2-foot embankment. You know, you could walk along that little embankment right alongside the wall, and they used to hit balls so that the ball, the fungo, to practice, and Sneed would get down and run up that slope and catch the ball. So this particular day, somebody hit a ball, and it looked to Smead like the ball was going to hit off the wall, so he ran up the bank to the ledge, but the ball fell down at the base of the slope. He could have caught it if he stayed down there. So when he saw what happened, he started down and fell headlong. So when he came down, Marty McManus used some profanity, and Smead, he says, we practiced you for a week of how to run up that bank. He said, yeah, but he said, but nobody practiced me how to run down it. They had all kinds of stories about Smead.
And you had old Bob Fothergill that year, too.
Hit line drive after line drive coming off the bench.
Yeah.
He was as round as he was tall.
Exactly. I saw him, first game I ever saw in Major Leagues, I was on my way to be a freshman at Notre Dame. I came to St. Louis on the train.
Yeah.
That time between trains, and going out to Sportsman's Park and saw the Browns play the Tigers, and he was leading the league in hitting at that point for the Tigers.
He could hit.
Yeah, he could hit.
Strong.
Yeah. 34, you had your best hitting season anyway, average-wise, 321. And stole 40 bases, which was your high for stolen bases.
I broke my toe at the end of that season with about 10 days to run. And I was never the same ball player again.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Big toe or
this big toe right here, that joint.
Yeah.
And during that winter, I had a calcium block develop on the anterior part of the joint, and a spur developed inside of the joint. Seeing during the winter, I didn't know what I had done. So it was sore, but I thought that during the winter it would heal.
Yeah.
And then during 1935, I laid the leg in stolen bases running on bad legs.
Sure you did.
But I had to quit. In other words, I had to quit playing ball along toward the end of the 35 season.
Uh-huh.
And I went to the Washington ballpark to see a ball game in the latter part of the 35 season. And I ran into a Dr. Lennox Baker there. Dr. Lennox Baker was the trainer at Duke University when I was there, and at the time I ran into him at the Washington ballpark, he was resident physician to Dr. George Bennett at Hopkins Hospital. And he asked me, "What the hell are you doing here?" And I told him about my toe. He said, "Well, come over to Hopkins and let Dr. George Bennett look at it." Dr. George Bennett was, at that time, perhaps the eminent orthopedic surgeon in America, mm-hmm. and a fine gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
He operated on DiMaggio and a number of athletes. So I called, and Dr. Baker, incidentally, the orthopedic hospital unit at Duke University is the Lennox D. Baker Orthopedic Hospital now. He later went to Duke and became one of the noted orthopedic surgeons in America. Same fellow I'm talking about.
Sure.
So I went over there in the fall of 35, and Dr. Bennett x-rayed and looked at the toe and told me what I had. And he said, "If you let it stay as it is, you're not going to play any more baseball." He says, "If I repair the toe for you," he says, "you may not play any more baseball," because your toe is not going to stand the pounding that it will have to take.
Yeah.
Now, if I operate on it, he says, and you do play, he says, you're going to aggravate it, and he says, eventually you'll have to have the work done again. So I had no choice. He operated on me, and I played about 8 more years on that bad foot.
Was that one of the reasons you retired? When you did?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was increasingly painful, and it was affecting the backs of my legs. And I'd sit like this in the movie of Plain Bridge, and then sit like that.
Uh-huh.
And ultimately, it became so painful to hunt, to walk on.
Sure.
I called Baker, and Baker at that time was down at Duke. He left Hopkins,
mm-hmm.
and he made a new toe joint for me. He went in there and never charged me a dime.
Nice
fellow. I correspond with him. As a matter of fact, every time I go to Duke, I call him on the phone, and we have lunch and dinner and one way or another.
Tell me a little about Lefty Grove.
Well, I could talk about Lefty Grove a long time. I'm a great admirer, still, and was a great admirer of Lefty Groves when Lefty was pitching.
Mm-hmm.
Lefty was a fine person. Lefty was a person of moderation. When Lefty left the ballpark, he went home to his family.
Mm-hmm.
He allowed himself about one cigar a day.
Mm-hmm.
He allowed himself about one drink a day.
Mm-hmm.
He went to bed about 9 o'clock every night. He kept himself in marvelous physical condition all of his life. He had the guts of a burglar. Lefty Grove, in this book that I've written, I stated that if there was a ball game, if I was manager of a ball game, and there was one ball game, if I was manager of a ball team, and there was one ball game that I had to win, he's the man that I would pitch.
Yeah.
Because he didn't want to be beaten there, ever.
He really didn't like to lose.
He didn't like to lose. And he wasn't one of these guys, you know, you throw 60 or 70 or 80 or 90 or 100 pitchers, look to the dugout, and I've thrown my 100 pitches, it's time for me to come out.
Yeah.
If the ball game went 13 or 14 or 15 innings, and the decision was not cut, he didn't want the manager to come out of the dugout.
Yeah.
One year, he had an infected tooth, or he might have had a couple of them, and his arm was sore, and in spring training, he couldn't pitch. I don't know what year it was. It could have been 34, it could have been 35.
Well, I think it was 34, because he was 8-8 that season.
Well, he
has SAA, and they've got a...
He decided he was all through with baseball, and he was going home. And
Had sore arm.
Had sore arm. Yeah. And Phil Troy, the secretary, talked him into going to Boston and get examined.
Mm-hmm.
And so they found these infected teeth and they had them extracted. And in the course of time, the poison that was going through his system left him.
Yeah.
But he hadn't pitched enough in spring training to toughen up his fingers.
Mm-hmm.
And in the ball game in Detroit, after he did start to pitch, he struck out somebody in the fourth inning or the fifth inning or something like that. And Rick Farrell threw the ball to me at third base, and when I got it to throw to Larry at short, I noticed there was blood on the ball. And so instead of talking about Larry, I walked on in the group and I said, blood all over the ball. I said, what the hell's the matter with you? And he had no skin, that dermis or epidermis or whatever you call it, had gone there, and he was pitching with this stuff drawing bleed. I said, Lefty, get out of there. I said, you can't pitch like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he addressed me in some unturnable language and told me to get my ass out back to third base. He said, you did play third base. He said, I'll do the pitching. He went on pitching. But now Lefty was with the public and with the press, was an entirely different type of person. If you had asked for this interview, the chances are you wouldn't have gotten it.
I understand.
Yet, if you'd gotten it with me and he'd been here, he'd have joined in the conversation and you would have liked him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Lefty used to come to my house at dinner and we'd go to his place. He's the only man that I've ever seen that had a very efficient way of buttering his corn. He'd put butter all over a slice of bread and then put the corn in the bread and roll it.
I'll be dead. He had it figured. Really did. All right.
He was a great man.
Mm-hmm.
Great pitcher. The best.
That's hard to argue against. In 35, Joe Cronin came along to manage.
Yes, sir.
Was he as good a manager as he was a player?
I never liked Joe Cronin. Joe Cronin in 1933 made some bad remarks about the Red Sox in the Boston dugout along third base.
Hmm.
And I waited for him. This is 33.
Yeah.
When he came by third base. And I caught him on it. They won the championship that year and they won it by feasting on us. They beat us about 18 ball games.
Hmm.
So I didn't care much for what he said.
Yeah.
And when he came by there, I let him know it. And he said, I didn't mean anything by it. He said, I'm just trying to inspire the troops. Mm-hmm. Something to that effect.
Yeah.
But the next year, when we opened up in Washington in 1934, our opening game was in Washington. And if you look at that opening game, I got 4-for-4. And I got 8-for-8 on Cronin. Because I stayed at him as long as he was in the ball game. I stayed after him every minute of the ball game. And if during the 34th season, he and I had a fight every time he challenged me to fight, we'd have both been banned from baseball forever. along toward the latter part of the year, he hurt himself. I think he broke his wrist or did something. But toward the latter part of the year, we came into the Washington. Oh, and Harris said to me, he said, there's your friend out at shortstop, get after him. I said, no, I feel sorry for the guy, I'm going to leave him alone. So during that winter,
he had a broken arm.
Broken arm.
Yeah.
During that winter, Yawkey paid $250,000 to Griffith for Cronin. And I picked up the morning paper and I saw the headline at breakfast.
Yeah.
The Red Sox by Cronin, so and so. And I said to this young lady here, I said, I said, it looks like our playing days for Boston are over. Cronin's coming over to manage. Now, I'm going to say this. When he got over to Boston, I changed my attitude. Joe Cronin, pretty good fellow.
That's good.
And I'd say he was a pretty good manager. And I'd say he tried to get along well with everybody. And I'd say he leaned over backwards to get along with me. And I say this, he's a good competitor, and a good hitter, and a good man.
I saw him play his first major league game with Pittsburgh in 1926.
Yeah. He made, for a fellow with minimal education, he made a hell of a lot out of what he had.
I think you're right.
He's to be admired and respected.
In 35, you had two great pitchers that carried the Red Sox. Farrell won 25 and Grove won 20.
Yeah.
And the next one was Johnny Welch with 10.
Yeah, he won most of those pitching against Washington. I got in a taxi cab with a man by the name of Welch in St. Louis, Missouri, riding from Chase Hotel when I was in Cincinnati, and asked him if he'd ever known of anybody. Johnny Welch was from St. Louis, and he said, John Welch is my brother.
Oh, I'll be darned.
And I said, how is he? And he said, he's dead. And I said, what did he die from? He said, tuberculosis.
Ooh, that's a shame. Because he had to be pretty young, didn't he?
Yeah, you could see what he's been. Laziest man I ever saw in my life. You know, if he was in the outfield and pitchers would get in the outfield or in batting practice, and a ball was hit from here to my dining room table from him, he wouldn't run to catch it. He would, after the ball hit, he'd walk from here over there and pick it up.
Now, in 36, Jimmy Fox and Doc Kramer came to the Red Sox.
Yes, sir. Doc Kramer belongs in the Hall of Fame. Doc Kramer is one of the all-time great center fielders. You never hear anybody talk about him.
Well, I
played in the outfield beside that guy. Cronin would move me to the outfield every now and then.
Yeah, I noticed you played some.
Because I could throw.
Mm-hmm.
I had a great arm.
Yeah, you played 45 games in the outfield in 36.
And he had McNair.
Yeah.
And he'd, Eric, move me into the outfield, and that Kramer, you know, that Kramer, the ball was hitting in my area, and you're running like the devil. He'd be over there beside you telling you how far you were from the wall, and if the ball was hit on the ground between you, and you were going to feel it. He was watching the base runner telling you where to throw when you came with the ball. A lot of things.
Yeah, and a great hitter.
Great hitter. Hell, he was a...
Yeah. And you had Dusty Cook and Mel Armada. Also in the outfield.
I saw where Mel died just the other day.
Yeah, not long ago. All right, now in 37 you went to the
A's. Mel Armada made the one greatest catch I ever saw.
How was that?
Bill Dickey hit the ball in Yankee Stadium. Mel Armada was playing right field. Mel was a left-hand thrower. He ran to the wire fencing, the big, thick, heavy anchor fencing that was atop a wood frame, a concrete frame. They had bleachers out there.
Yeah.
And he jumped as high as he could and grabbed a hold of the top of that anchor fencing with his bare left hand and then held himself there, hanging like a big monkey, while he kept his eye on that ball coming down. And then he reached over that anchor wire fencing with that gloved hand and caught that ball out of the stands.
That's incredible.
But what made it such a great catch was that he hung on that fence for such a long period of time while that ball was descending to catch a home run off Bill Dickey.
And he had the instinct or good luck to go up on the fence at the right
the
spot.
The right spot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gee, well.
Yeah.
So, were you traded to the A's or the Senior or what?
No, Crumlin got Pinky Higgins from the A's, and they...